Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Michael Morris. Let's get into the first news story of today. And the DA is beginning its court case challenging the amendments to the Employment Equity Act. Federal chairperson of the DA, Helen Ziller, who was briefly a former colleague of ours, said, quote, "If this law is enacted, for example, people belonging to a specific group concentrated in a geographical area could face exclusion from employment based on national quotas set by the minister. The DA has committed everything we can do to build a country where everyone has the opportunity to shape their future on the basis of their ability and hard work, not because the government determines whether and where you can work based on the color of your skin. We don't want to have a country that continues to define everybody by their race and other biological attributes they don't have control over, and make sure everyone understands their ability, opportunity, and work ethic is what's going to get them to the top, not their race and their political connections. Companies and political investors have repeatedly cited these social engineering laws as major barriers to investment and growth. It is completely senseless to knowingly intensify a discriminatory regime that has failed so spectacularly to empower economically marginalized people." Michael, that seems pretty good to me in terms of a claim, and I congratulate the DA for challenging this one. This law is quite, or these amendments, these regulations are quite insidious. They basically allow the government to kind of almost micromanage to the geographic representativity, race. It's kind of, imagine a system where the government kind of gets to choose who works where, what kind of work they can do, how many people can be promoted to a certain level. This system is so mad that while a lot of the focus has been on white South Africans and their potential to be excluded under some of these regulations, they don't just affect white South Africans, they affect everybody. You could have a situation where there are, and this has happened in other places in the country at certain times, too many black women in a position. No, we need more black men. Therefore, we're not going to hire any more black women. Too many Indian women in this position. No, there needs to be black men in this position. It is completely mad. And it is exactly the wrong approach to actually fixing the problems in this country. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I quoted our colleague Gabriel Krauser in my Business Day column yesterday, from a piece that I think he wrote towards the end of last year, in which he pointed out this very simple fact that poor black unemployed people, that's the bulk of South Africa, are the most clearly stuck in the shadow of apartheid, a shadow that has grown under BEE. And removing obstacles to investment is the best way to remove the shadow. So that's the kind of the macro picture, which tends to be overlooked when supporters of BEE or affirmative action get down to arguing with us. They tend to kind of accuse us of being right-wing or racist. They want to talk about the kind of absence of empowerment in the very particular sense that these laws are intended to produce or promote. And the sad fact is that they don't. That the record shows exactly the opposite. So if one looks, for instance, at South African black unemployment, having increased from 5.5 million on the expanded definition in 2008, 5.5 million in 2008, to 11.1 million in 2024. That's the most chronic problem that South Africa faces. And it has increased under conditions in which the kind of racialized law has been intensified. The government has doubled down on it. Strenuously tried to defend it when quite clearly the consequences are very, very dire for the poorest. The wealthy people who might be cronies, well connected, politically connected, they're doing pretty well. And we see that in they're selling a broom that would cost 27 Rand, they sell it for 280 Rand, say, or a school that should have cost 5 million Rand to build costs 14 million in the end. So it's all these extra costs, the overspending that's piled on in the name of this apparently noble objective, which in fact is now increasingly beginning to be seen as ignoble, completely unattainable, immoral, actually, really, considering the economic conditions that most people live under. South Africa with the highest youth unemployment in the world. I mean, that is just on its own. And just one final thing that I think is worth mentioning, because you don't see it referred to a lot. is UNICEF, the UN Children's Fund, telling us that 23% of children in South Africa are classified as living in severe child food poverty. And it calculates that 1.5 million South African children, you just picture 1.5 million, putting them into schools of 700,000 or 7,000 per school or 1,000 per school. How many schools do you fill up with 1.5 million children? That's 3 out of every 10 are already stunted because of poverty. And that means that, quote, these children will likely not reach their full growth and developmental potential because of the irreversible physical and cognitive damage caused by persistent nutritional deprivation. So this is the setting, and I think Helen Zilla sets that out very well in the passage that you read. This is the setting in which people who really do care about South Africa are making an argument for a different policy, a completely different approach, empowerment of a different approach, actually, which is very much an IRR position.
Yeah. The proponents of BEE always seem to kind of don't really have an answer to this problem of, you know, this has been one of the most aggressively pursued policies, particularly within the state, but increasingly in the private sector for the last, you know, however many years. And if, you know, this was hurting white people and helping black people, I would still think that it was immoral because I do not like racial discrimination, but at least there would be an argument for it then. You could say, okay, well, you know, it's helping these people and these people were hurt in the past. But that's not what it's doing. It's not helping anyone except the politically connected and those essentially who have already kind of made it to the middle class. Those people who would find employment in the private sector would be able to survive without BEE are exactly the ones who benefit from it. And as you say, the cost is borne primarily by those who have not made it. It also, as I think, does very little to improve race relations. It has a thousand bad effects. And every time we raise these objections, the sort of proponents of BEE will say, well, no, it's just because we haven't done it hard enough. May I submit that perhaps we should try something different, the definition of insanity and all being you know, doing the same thing over and over again.
Yes, exactly. Right. And, you know, I mean, the thing that always strikes me, and I think it's always worth mentioning because people tend to forget it, is that the perfect model is actually offered by the SASSA grant system, which every month keeps millions of people away from abject poverty by handing out the cash that, you know, keeps at least some food on the table for them. And that is a completely non-racial system. And that is actually all that we are arguing for with the IRR. We say there is a way to do this without having the divisive effects that you've referred to, without having the effects on investment that is now everybody knows about. It's legion. It is possible to actually look at who do we need to really empower. Empowerment, you know, quite clearly is something, it's a long delay, long deferred challenge that we still live with, and that's shocking after 30 years. And the trick would be to do it by focusing on where it's actually needed, and abandoning the racialism. Yeah,
economic growth, investment, jobs, that's the only way to go.
Yeah.
Speaking of solutions to South Africa's problems that aren't going to work, an ANC MP, member of parliament, CB, was speaking to the media, and he was reflecting on his personal views. He didn't say that these were the views of the ANC, but he was reflecting on his personal views, and I think this is a current you do see in the country by and large about what we really need to fix South Africa's problems. He said, quote, "If you have to follow this constitution, it's a good one, but people take advantage of it. Let's look at the issue of human rights. Someone invades land, and when you want to remove that person, the Human Rights Commission comes in and issues of human rights are raised and so on and so on. So it is something that we need to look at as parliament, different political parties. But like I say, my personal view is that our democracy, which is so good, leads a little bit of dictatorship. I'm not convinced that we are a level where we are patriotic. That is why we are able to demand a clinic and we damage the road. We are able to burn a school because we are not getting water. So we are not there yet. We need to instill the issue of patriotism so that the way we are cultured and start to appreciate the little we have and build on that. Now, I have some sympathy for this view. You know, it is tragic whenever you see South Africans doing something so destructive to demand accountability from their government is damaging the very infrastructure that they do have, burning the local school, damaging the local water infrastructure, whatever it might be. And that is something that should be shamed. And I don't think that people who do that should be let off the hook. But this thing of little bit of dictatorship, you know, just like a little sprinkle, it's a seductive siren. And I think it's many South Africans of all walks of life probably have some sympathy for that view. But the reality is, firstly, a little bit of dictatorship is far less efficient than you'd think. And secondly, a little bit of dictatorship very quickly can turn into a lot of dictatorship if you're not very careful. And it's not a very good way of solving problems. I don't know, Michael, what's your take on this?
I think there is an appeal in this, probably right across the world. You know, a lot of people, generally those people who do have a stake, and who don't necessarily behave in this way, feel that it ought to be punished in some way. There needs to be some kind of strong man to step in and say, you can't do that, and if you do, you're going to be punished. But my own views is that people who...
Just on that point, it is already illegal to burn down a school. We don't need a dictator.
And that is a key point. You know, what we need is efficient services, efficient policing, efficient prosecutorial services. People need to know that if they do overstep the boundaries of a civilized society, there will be consequences. So that's absolutely essential on the one hand. On the other hand, people need to, or just people behave differently if they really do have a stake. And you can't fake that. People either feel and know that they have a stake in society. They've got property rights, perhaps. They've got a job. They're living in a society that's governed properly. The services they're promised are actually delivered by people who, you know, are paid to do the job. They're there in the morning and they'll do the job, whether it's a teacher or a person behind a counter. So all of that speaks to whether people have a sense that they really do belong in the society. They have a stake there. They have a stake in its future and they're optimistic about it. And those people are not going to burn down anything or dig up a road or whatever it is that protesters sometimes do. Usually when they do it, there might well be those who are, there's, you know, a kind of criminal intent or this, you know, mob rage. These things happen to even the most sophisticated people, I think, can be prone to that kind of sentiment or that kind of, mob dynamic that develops. But it's not an expression or a reflection of people who are lacking some kind of cultural attribute or some kind of civilizational value. It's simply people who are deprived who have no stake. So between the two of them, that's really where the attention needs to lie. It's precisely the kinds of things that we emphasized in discussing the last story. It's, you know, solutions that are focused on practical outcomes, getting that done, focusing on who really needs help. I think that would be a major step towards doing this. But of course, the other thing is democracy is difficult. It's challenging. Freedom is difficult and challenging. It wouldn't be difficult if it weren't properly free and open. So that is always a greater advantage for any society. I think all of history shows that open, free societies prosper in ways that closed, tyrannical societies never can do. And I think that's really the lesson that he needs to internalize.
That's exactly because free societies are able to self-correct. They can make mistakes, but they have the ability to say, okay, wait, we've made a mistake. Let's change our government. Let's change the way we think about this. Let's change our policy. Whereas dictatorships tend to just double down until they fall apart when they make a mistake, because there is no real self-corrective mechanism. And that is one of the wonderful things about freedom. Exactly. Even as messy and chaotic and inefficient as it can be sometimes, at the end of the day, you can at least change the direction you're going in. All right, let's talk about our last story.
A little bit of a kind of related here,
but I think this is kind of connected. It's connected in the sense that this is about people having a stake in governments and governing. There's been some work recently. I think a councillor in Tshwane did some work to claim that the city of Tshwane is over the peak of the Laffer curve. And this was a view endorsed by Darby Ruart. And basically the idea is that there's a certain point at which you tax people when you get diminishing returns from that tax, no matter how high you set the tax rate, because either the tax stifles economic growth or tax evasion becomes so prevalent that you just don't recoup money when you raise taxes further. And I think there's a good argument to be made that South Africa as a whole has kind of actually reached that point in a big way. We see on personal income tax, on corporate tax. This is specifically in the context of municipalities. I think it's fair to say that a lot of people across the country are not paying their rates because they just don't really see the point. It's like, well, you know, the roads are going to be broken, the money's going to get stolen and fed to caterers or whatever. So why should I pay? I'm just a sucker if I pay. And of course, this means that there's shortages of money. So even if you do want to do something, you can't do it, and it creates a negative cycle.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on this, Michael?
Yeah. I mean, I certainly agree with that. It's a very interesting bit of research that Lex Middleburg, I see he's a councillor from the Republican Congress of Tshwane. I've never heard of that, but he's done this analysis of Tshwane's financial statements over recent years. So very interesting. I mean, I spoke to somebody quite recently here in Cape Town, and you and I know we're both living in Cape Town, that, you know, we're pretty lucky actually living in a city that's well-run and responsive. But we are apparently about to face some fairly hefty rises in rates charges and so on. And this fellow was kind of saying to me that you know, he just found this outrageous and he was going to object to it and so on. And I said, well, you know, perhaps part of his argument was, you know, all it's going to be spent on enlarging the bureaucracy. We're not going to get anything out of it. And I said, well, you know, we are living in a city that is very unlike Johannesburg and other cities in South Africa. Maybe we are getting something out of it. We do need to pay for what we're getting. But what struck me was just the sentiment, even in Cape Town, is influenced by what we all know, even living in Cape Town, is pervasive across the country, is that, you know, things not working and money being wasted and corruption being high. And it, I think it does influence everybody's thinking, even if they're living in a well-run city, that they just resent paying anything more to any kind of official agency because the reputational damage is now so intense that they associated with everybody, which I think is unfair. And this chap is, you know, he was quite struck at that I was actually arguing, putting forward an alternative argument. And he kind of grudgingly acknowledged that. But I could still see that, you know, the atmosphere in which we're talking about these things is one in which there is chronic dysfunction and incompetence and fraud and so on. So it's a big risk to society when people begin to feel that they're not going to invest in the services that they are actually getting, and that is a problem.
Now, that's exactly kind of what happened to Greece when it went through its debt crisis, where everyone said, we're not going to pay taxes anymore because the politicians are rubbish and we don't like them and they steal everything and they're useless. And then there was no money to pay the bills, and then it only got worse from there, created the disastrous, unvirtuous cycle. And it is a thing that you need to. But I do think the key is that government is really the one that needs to be the first mover here and show, okay, you really can trust us. And people will never want to pay more money for something, but the amount they're willing to put up with will be higher if you give them good stuff.
Exactly.
Okay, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for watching. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow with the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.